There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 206. With me today, I have Meredith Angwin, who blogs at Yes Vermont Yankee and runs the Energy Education Project for the Ethan Allen Institute. Margaret Harding, who is an independent consultant and runs a blog called Four Factor Consulting and has about 30 years worth of experience in designing boiling water reactor fuel design. Steve Applin, who is a blogger at Canadian Energy Issues, and me. So, welcome to all of you tonight.
Great to be here.
Yeah, I enjoyed the opportunity to work with you this last week, Margaret. Thank you very much for coming.
You're very welcome. It was a fun fun little event to everybody to know. The Virginia chapter of ANS, Virginia section, had a teacher workshop last week at this past week at VCU. Sama Bilbao y León was, I think, the main coordinator. Rod did some of the work. I'm not sure who else was involved. But Rod asked Andrea, Janetta, and I to talk about front end and back end. And then I was the after-dinner speech. So I amused with stories and statistics and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I'm sorry I couldn't stay for the whole talk in the evening. I was running low on energy and had a 2.5-hour drive in front of me, so I snuck out. But I appreciate the time. It was a good group of people, the high school and middle school teachers trying to get some continuing education credits and increase their knowledge of nuclear energy and radiation measurement. And during the day that I coordinated the Thursday event, not only do we talk about the back end and front end of the fuel cycle, but we also had a experienced teacher teaching about how she uses various exercises to get people to understand a little bit more about get her students to understand a little bit more about radiation. And we had Reed Johnson show people how to use a radiation detector. Pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, it really was good. It was very positive. Obviously, the teachers were at least open-minded. I think most of them were, in fact, pro-nuclear. But it was refreshing to talk to them and have them excited about the chance to show their students the information and an accurate portrayal of the technology. That was a lot of fun.
Well, one of the nice things about high school science and math teachers is that they're generally pro-science and pro-math. And if you're those two, you probably have a hard time being anti-nuclear.
Yeah. And in fact, when you talk, my son, I found this true with my son's teachers as well. A lot of times nowadays, high school science teachers are not unusual for them to have had a career, or at least for a few years worked in industry in the subject that they're now teaching. Like, one of the gentlemen there was a chemistry, I'm not sure what his degree was in, but he did chemistry research with, some of the large bioscience labs. So had a definite background in the stuff he was teaching. And a passion for it,
yeah,
which is very exciting to have.
Yeah,
one of the teachers.
One of the teachers I talked to was the kind of guy that I thought was a great one to have at this workshop. He's a machinist, and he teaches at Central Virginia Community College in technical courses. And
yeah.
One of the talks that we had during this workshop was by Caleb Tompkins from the NAYGN, who talked about some of the opportunities in the nuclear industry that are not nuclear engineering, but are mechanical and electrical and welding and machining opportunities for technicians. And that's one of the areas where I think that if I was to identify any issue with expanding the nuclear industry in the near term, it's the fact that we don't have as many people available to do those kind of tasks as we did during the first nuclear age.
Is that not what's standing in the way of the, well, this is something that was cited when Areva was explaining the delays in the MOX project, the talent gap. Is that one of the things that they were, is that some of the areas of trades that are sort of deficient? It certainly is here, like all the things that you just mentioned, all the skilled trades especially. There's a real labor crunch in that area.
Well, it certainly has been a problem, and not only those areas that I mentioned, but even such things as people who pour concrete or lay rebar. Is an area where, you know, we just haven't done or haven't encouraged those kinds of training programs at the high school and community college level as much as we probably should have. You know, I don't know about most of you, but I know that when I was growing up, I never thought of anything other than going straight to college.
College, there's some interesting studies that have been done, and I can't say where I read these or heard about them now. Too much information comes at me from esoteric sources. But there's been a huge emphasis, at least in the U.S., about everybody going to college. And it appears to be increasingly evident that, A, we need people that want to do skilled trades or other trade work. I mean, fixing cars and putting together stuff and those kinds of things. And but we tend to really push in high school, the emphasis on shop classes and other trades courses in schools has been very, very much de-emphasized. It's, I think, a more expensive part of the curriculum, and when they cut costs at schools, they look at all the material costs there and say, well, gee, we can get rid of shop. We want the kids to go to college anyway, and that's really an error because we are always going to need that mix if we want to be a strong nation.
Well, one of the things that I've been thinking about this quite a lot because my wife tends to like to watch the Food Channel.
No, me too.
And it appears to me that one of the areas where we seem to still encourage kids to quote, manufacture things or use chemistry is in the kitchen. The idea of being a chef seems to be a very popular potential career path. Maybe we can get some of the kids out of the kitchen and into the shop. But
well, don't you think though that the whole thing about the chefs is that you have these celebrity chefs?
Yeah,
I mean, they're not just on the Food Channel. They've got they're a brand, you know, and they have their K-cup coffees and their, you know, magazines, and I mean, it's a whole thing. And I don't think that encouraging people to be chefs, to me, in our current situation, is more like encouraging people to be movie stars than encouraging people to be skilled auto mechanics.
Most of them discover if they actually choose a path. It's not all it's cracked up to be. It is where, you know, it's like I'm going to become a Hollywood actor. Your chances of getting anywhere, too bad Andrea's not here because she's a baseball fan. It's like your chance of becoming a Major League Baseball player if you play professional baseball. The odds are stacked against it. It's some celebrity dream that very, very few people actually realize. But you're right, it's chemical engineering. What is a pot? A pot is a chemical reactor.
Yeah, we got to an interesting conversation at dinner, Rod, at Thursday night with the teachers at my table. I ended up sitting at a table with three women teachers, and we were talking about women in engineering in the United States, and they were, you know, wow, when you were in there, it must have been really different. And I said, unfortunately, it's actually not that much different. That it was about 10% when I was in school, and it's 10 to 15% today of the engineering students are women, depending on the degree program. And I think this is somewhat true for men too, but of course we were specifically talking about women in this conversation, but they were saying, well, you know, what's the deal? What do we know why? And I said, well, there's statistics that tell us that women choose to go away from the hard subjects that they need in high school, mostly math, in junior high. And I think that's also true for the boys, that they want to be rich and famous. There's that hero worship. I want to be rich and famous. Okay, well, great. That's not very many people that get to succeed at that. What are you going to do to become rich and famous? Are you going to be the next Bill Gates or Steve Jobs or, you know, Warren Buffett, where you do something really smart? No, I just want to be rich and famous. You want to be Paris Hilton? Oh, well, okay, that's a little tougher. You know, that she was born to money, guys. You know, unless your parents were rich, you're not going to get that job. And so there's, you know, there's that little bit of a tendency to move away from, and once you move away from math, the hard sciences become much harder to gain.
Well, you become basically impossible.
Right.
I was just thinking about, many years ago, I went to a meeting in Mexico, a geothermal group I was in it after we were having a meeting at a Mexican research facility, and a group of us were giving our presentations, and one after another, and being introduced. And when a professional engineer was introduced in Mexico, he was introduced as Engineer Hernandez. I mean,
right.
Because just like you might say, a doctor so-and-so, you know, because it was a title of great respect, Engineer Hernandez, you know, Dr. Hughes, et cetera. And yet I was at a meeting at a business school, and, well, I don't want to give too much away to hide the guilty parties, but I was with a woman engineer, and we were at a meeting at a business school. And after the meeting, she went up to the presenter, who was presenting on business subjects, and she gave him her card. And he looked at it and said, "This PE, does that mean petroleum engineer or something? What does it mean?"
Good. Yeah.
So,
in Canada, and Steve, you can correct me, I worked with the guys at Aecon, and they don't use the title engineer. They don't say they're an engineer unless they're a licensed PE. That's what I noticed.
You're not supposed to here either, actually. And well, you can under certain circumstances, but if you're in front of testifying before a committee or anything like that, or even giving a statement before any kind of public body, you're not supposed to call yourself an engineer unless you're licensed to be.
Unless you're licensed and PN.
Right. You can't give testimony. You can't call yourself an expert witness as an engineer. But if you've been trained as an engineer, you can say you're an engineer.
Yeah. Well, I
just can't testify.
I always like to use the, I'm not an engineer, but I played one in the Navy. Kind of playing on I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night. But
yeah, I actually used a similar line with at the start of my speech in my after dinner speech, because I'm not a professional communicator, although I have played one on TV.
Yes. Yes. And you have, and you've done a great job at it.
Yes, yes, I have.
Thank you. But anyway.
But getting back to, I'm going to kind of diverge a little bit. I wanted to say that I started this little group out here where we're reading books by Neville Shute, who's, you know, he wrote On the Beach. Everybody knows On the Beach. Well, he's written a lot of other books. Well, one of the things about his books is the respect for engineers, people who build models, people who work with their hands. It's just, you know, it's like entering into a whole other world compared to most modern novels. And, I mean, I just kind of wish more people would be reading some of his books.
I will pick up one now. I didn't know that the...
Well, you know, like, for example, the... No Highway. You've got, you've got the hero, the engineer's hero, right? Or there's his last book, wonderful book, a very sweet book called Trustee from the Tool Room, about this guy who he doesn't make much of a living, but he's a really good model engineer. He builds very small models, and then he writes them up for a book called The Model Engineer, a magazine. And then everybody writes him and asks him questions and says, so I was trying to follow your directions, and this went wrong. And then he writes them back and so forth and so on. And he's poking along this way. He's very good at what he does. But then his sister dies in Tahiti, which is a whole other story in itself, and he has to go out and deal with the situation, but he doesn't have any money. And he begins traveling, and he begins to realize all over the world there are people who've been reading his books who say, Keith Richards, your model engineer? Really? Anyway, it's just so sweet. It's one of the nicest books.
The Tool, sorry, what's
Trustee,
it called?
Trustee from the Tool Room.
Trustee from the Tool Room.
Tool Room.
Tool Room.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. I'm now here's the song. But I guess the thing is I just kind of wish that there was more respect in the society for people who just do something and turn out a product and turn it out well. And there's a whole thing when you're reading a novel nowadays, it turns out that there's usually some kind of wild conspiracy at the highest levels, and that's how the novel unfolds, which is one of the reasons that some of these older novels, where the protagonists are not at the highest levels, are really quite reassuring and lovely.
I've got a friend who falls totally in that category. He's a model airplane designer. And he makes his living selling this stuff on the internet all over the world.
Yeah, one of my favorite colleagues at B&W is a classic model maker. He's actually put together some amazing models of our product, including a complete scale model of the full reactor system, and then a scale model of the building layout. Incredible details, and he's fun to talk to because he will tell you how he finds things that can become these tiny little tires on the models that are maybe, you know, an automobile maybe the size of a fingernail. And so you have to find really interesting things to become the pieces of those models and make it work out. Fascinating guy to talk to. And, of course, he also does a lot of good CAD work, too. So he's a classic model maker who's trained himself to use modern tools as well. But
I think it's just, I guess the thing is, I think that a lot of things in the world would be different if there were more people who understood that at all kinds of levels, humans are problem solvers. And so the guy who's looking at your car is doing, you know, high-level problem solving. You know, you tell him what you heard. He drives it around a little bit. He puts it up on the rack and looks under it. He's doing very high-level problem solving.
Yep.
And yet, there's a kind of scornfulness that the only problem solving is done somehow by people who have college degrees. And depending on what they're doing with their college degrees, they could spend a lot of their day problem solving, or they could spend a lot of their day doing rather dull, repetitive things.
Well,
I've
been reading a lot recently about people who graduate from college with enormous debts, and in some cases, particularly over the last several years, many of the people graduating with enormous debts have had a real difficult time getting a job. And when I read some of the stories, you know, I can't believe I can't get a job. I've got this degree in social psychology or art history or I can't remember some of the other degrees. I can't believe I can't get a job. Somebody somewhere along the line didn't help you understand that in order to get a job, you need to be able to solve problems for your employer. You know, people will employ you if, because they have you on staff, they will increase their sales more than what they're going to pay you. because, you know, you are solving problems or helping their customers or creating a product.
Yeah. There's a certain level of, I was maybe annoyingly practical in high school and into college. In high school, I had my music teacher want me to major in flute and my English teacher want me to major in writing. And I looked at both of them and said, I'd really rather eat. I'm going to be an engineer.
Well, today,
I'll do those other things for a hobby. Thank you very much.
Today, this is an argument for the skilled trades. There's a shortage. They pay well. And it's direct benefit to, you can see what you did at the end of the day.
There's something very satisfying about that. Those of us that have what I'll say is more, I don't like to use the word cerebral, ephemeral jobs. There's not, when I used to do what I did for GE, and especially when I became a manager, I didn't walk out of the door going, I know I got this thing done. Because it was always a little more, you could always do a little more. There was always something else that needed to happen. And even today as a consultant, what we do, there's frequently not at the end of the day a satisfying, I've completed something.
One of the easiest jobs I've had in terms of actually figuring out what I accomplished during the course of the day was when I was a manager for a factory and was very involved in scheduling and production and trying to produce orders and those kinds of things. And at the end of the day, when I could see the pallets full of product getting ready to be shipped, that was quite satisfying that we actually accomplished what we set out to do. And maybe even when we had a few more boxes than what we'd planned to make because we worked a little bit harder, we got the machine running a little bit better. Those were satisfying days.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to getting to that point again, but unfortunately with the product I'm on now, it'll be a few years before we actually start shipping product.
Well, you got to go to a lower tech form of fuel. My cottage, I heat it with wood, and my brother and I have just been replenishing the wood stocks, which have been depleted over the last couple of years, and that is very satisfying. Mind you,
hard work.
Extremely inefficient. as a heat source, it's very nice to, you know, to fell the tree, saw it up in length, split the wood, stack it, and then I walk around the wood pile. I do this every single time I go there. I walk around the wood pile and I look at the wood that I've stacked. For some reason, it's a very satisfying thing to do. But it
would be less satisfying if you made the calculation and realized that you could replace all that wood with one or two pellets.
Oh, I know. I know this. And you know, all the work that I do in the wintertime, or the water is not winterized at this place either. So we have to haul the water out of the pails, out of the lake in pails, and then heat it on the stove. And all the work that I do with wood doing that, it's one flick of a dial on an electric stove does it quicker, far more efficiently. Yeah.
And with less smoke.
And with much less smoke, when you know the carbon content of the electricity, it's astounding.
Yeah, what was it Reagan used to say that heating your house with wood, you get to get warm twice.
Twice, yeah.
That's right.
Once
but
well shopping it, once
and,
well
and you get to forego a lot of other activities. You know, I'm undercutting my own argument. It's very it's very satisfying to look at this stuff. But I mean, if I was doing that full time, that's all I'd be doing.
Well,
our granddaughter was here for a while, and she knows that I'm all running around about electricity stuff, and so is her father, who works with Jeffrey Sachs at Earth Institute. Her father's a mechanical engineering professor at Columbia and works a lot with the Earth Institute. So she decided to want to know what happened before there was electricity. What was it like? Well, you know, how do you do this? So we watched the BBC movie 1900 House together. That's really, I recommend it. I mean, just sit down and get it from Netflix.
Yeah, that's an excellent film. Another good one is Wartime Farm. I don't know if you've seen that.
No, I saw a 1940 House. But once again, one of the things is that it just so 1900 house, everything is just so tedious. She's chasing the dust all over. It takes a full day to do the laundry. I mean, you know, that Hans Rosling, where he pulls the books out of the washing machine.
That was the next one.
There's a wonderful...
That was my grandmother, in 50 years ago.
Yeah, and my mom has said that was not her mother as much as her... Well, her mother a little bit, more her grandmother. She was the sod house thing on the prairie of Oklahoma. But there is a great section in the... There's a man whose life work, I can't remember his name, his life's work has been a biography of Lyndon Johnson.
Robert Carroll.
And the section that's on Johnson as a young man, he spends some time talking about one of the things Johnson did as a new congressman was to get West Texas electrified.
Yeah, the REA.
And the whole REA thing. And there's a whole chapter in that book that describes the lives of the women of the prairie, of the West Texas prairie in the 30s. So this is in the lifetimes of people living today. I mean, this isn't ancient history. These are women who were living there and in this country and the hell they went through to keep those households together in the prairie of West Texas, where there aren't many trees. So they were burning cow dung and whatever they could to heat the water, to wash the clothes, lugging water from the river, the whole bit. It's pretty amazing.
It wasn't a whole lot better in southeastern Georgia where my father grew up.
Right.
You know, he grew up on a farm where there was no electricity. I think he said he got his first electric lights when he was about 10 years old. It was definitely a different time and a much different way of life. But, you know, I'm going back to some of the things that we need to try to help encourage people to understand that, you know, there's a lot of benefit to being a high-producing worker without being the star, being part of a team, and really learning your job and doing it well. There's a lot of good things that come from that. You know, I often wonder sometimes the people who want to be rich and famous, if they really understood what it meant to not have privacy and to have photographers following you around all the time and all the other things that go along with that, if they would believe that was really the ideal way to live. Of course, the other issue that my mother was a high school teacher, and she often would bemoan the fact that some of her students, if she asked them what they really wanted to get out of life, they would say, "Well, I'm planning to win the lottery."
Right. Yeah, that's a great plan. As people like to say, hope is not a strategy. But yeah, I think unfortunately our cable TV lifestyle, you don't have to be anything to suddenly become rich and famous. You just have to be in the right place. And so I think there's a lot of kids out there with a very unrealistic view of what being an adult is like, and they look at their parents and think they were stupid for just being regular Joes with regular jobs. And I don't know how we combat that, to be honest, but I was excited to talk to those teachers because I just felt like they were excited to be educating their students. Here in the Carolinas, we have, for the nuclear industry in particular, we have what's called the The Carolina, I remember thinking it was a really unfortunate acronym. Anyway, it's an alliance of industry and junior colleges, technical schools, to train the skilled labor to work in this industry. And it's very exciting that they're doing that.
You know, another kind of related topic is something that we as a society have often bashed unions and forgotten about the fact that many unions have excellent training programs,
yep,
and do a tremendous job in imparting technical expertise. And for nuclear people, some of the trades are some of the best pro-nuclear advocates out there.
Yeah.
You know, I think in many cases the bashing of unions is because the elites are the people that write the stories in the media. You know, there certainly have been examples of unions that have been influenced by the mobs, but there's also an awful lot of very good trade associations that do a great job in training people. And, you know, I actually have a little bit of sympathy for those who organize to make sure that they get at least a good fair share of the wealth that comes from the work that they do.
Absolutely. They're the best. The unions are the best in Ontario, in my neck of the woods. The unions are the best and basically the only unconstrained nuclear advocates who, you know, whose presidents can go in front of a TV and say, speak their piece without fear of getting fired. Most of the executives can't do that. Most of the executives can't say anything to the media of the public utilities. And the ones who can are still constrained because they've got, you know, they're ultimately government owned. The unions can say pretty much whatever they want. And the unions here in Ontario are part owners of Bruce Power, so they've got some money to throw around as well. They're the pivotal players in nuclear advocacy in this province anyway.
Yeah, there was a time in the, you know, when there was an awful lot of talk about the nuclear renaissance. I remember having attending several conferences where there was representatives from the Building Trades Association, Construction Trades. I haven't seen much of that recently. Of course, for the last several years, we've kind of been victims of people saying that the Renaissance is dead, and maybe even accepted a little bit of that ourselves.
Not me. Never say die. The fight's not over, and it's looking good. Nuclear is still the incumbent. It's still a good, strong incumbent technology, and it's got staying power. And there will be a turnaround in the sort of external factors that have caused people to question whether the Renaissance will happen. And that number one factor is the low price of natural gas. The current low price of natural gas, that's going to change when it does.
The current low price is not. I mean, it's low.
It's exactly.
It's still twice what it was a year ago.
Yep.
And in some places, like the Northeast, it's twice that.
Yes, I know that.
Right.
When the electricity spikes occur, the Northeast pays about triple the rest of the country.
Right. Well, the average price of natural gas over the first 6 months of 2013, if you're north of the New York City gate, has been somewhere close to $7.50 per million BTU.
In the rest of the country, it's within 20 cents of $4 per million BTU.
Right.
More or less.
So, like I said, it's twice as much north of the New York City gate because there's kind of a constrained delivery system. And, of course, that average has got a lot of spikes in it. There have been times this year where the price of natural gas in New England was in excess of $30 per million BTU.
Yep.
And
January.
Yeah. And it also it spiked pretty recently during the heat wave. I don't think it got quite that high, but it was well over $15 a million BTU.
I was explaining that the issue of the Northeast isn't quantity, it's distribution. There's lots of natural gas around the country, but they couldn't get it where they needed to have it.
Well, at the same time that New England was paying $30 a million BTU for natural gas, North Dakota was flaring it.
You're right.
And that's not a distribution problem. That's a physical nature of the commodity problem because it's not easy to move gas. I mean, if gas was easier to move, people would put it under rail cars. like they do with oil. You know, we're able to transport oil out of North Dakota pretty easily, unless it, you know, has a brake problem and falls into
and derails in Quebec.
Yeah, then there's a problem. But natural gas is an inherently challenging commodity to move from place to place if there's no pipeline. I just read a story in Market Watch about a decision by Florida Power and Light to sign a contract to be the anchor customer for a new gas pipeline into Florida. The project is right now budgeted at $3.35 billion. And, of course, I would expect that that's probably going to be a over budget because gas pipelines tend to be difficult to site and build. You got an awful lot of owners. But I was amused to find out, you know who the owner of the pipeline consortium is for the FPL as the anchor customer?
Somebody in wind.
Well, yeah, it was somebody in wind, a company called Next Era.
Oh, yeah.
These guys. Yeah. They're suing everybody in Ontario who's opposing them.
I'm laughing, Steve, but you may not know this, but Next Era owns Florida Power and Light.
Oh, I didn't know this.
Yeah, they also they're the holding company that owns Florida Power and Light, and then they split off all the nuclear plants under Next Era as well. So, like, Duane Arnold is owned by NextEra, the other Florida Power and Light plants.
Well, that's interesting. They're not well liked in Ontario. They're a wind company in Ontario.
I think they're one of the largest wind companies or owner of wind farms in the U.S.
Yeah, I think they own a bunch of the ones in Iowa. I don't really know who owns those.
Yeah,
they might.
I think they, if I remember the number correctly, was just the last time I checked was maybe a few months ago. They owned about 20,000 megawatts worth of wind. Anyway, I guess unfortunately, I have a long standing favorable relationship with Florida Power and Light. I don't know much about the holding company though.
Yeah, I can't say much. I have to tell you guys a great story about Thursday, Rod, while we were doing our thing with the teachers. My husband was visiting a pair of cousins he has that lives in the Richmond and Charlottesville area, right outside Richmond. And they were in Charlottesville and walking through a mall, he and one of his cousins, and this nice young lady walked up to them and asked him to sign a petition for Greenpeace.
Oh, beautiful.
And my husband doesn't normally get to respond to those people because it's usually he and I walking together. And the nice young lady will come up and ask for my signature because they frequently ask the woman first, ask for my signature, and I go up and smoke. and the last time that happened, they then turned to him and he said, I'm with her. This time it was him and his cousin. And so the woman came up and said, we're have a position. Petition to get rid of coal. And Mark said, great idea. What are you going to do instead, though? Oh, we're going to do wind and solar and conservation. And he looked at her and said, what about nuclear? And she said, oh, nuclear is bad. It pollutes the water. And he said, no, it doesn't. What are you talking about? And she went off onto some tale of the heat pollution, and he's just went up on her. And, finally, his cousin put his arm around Bark and said to the lady, his wife is a nuclear engineer. She said, will you sign my petition? And he said, no.
I'm with him.
I'm with him. Mark was so proud of himself.
Well, that's good.
So he was asking me for all kinds of statistics so he could go after him better next time. It's pretty fun.
Well, I still remember the time that I left a nuclear energy press conference in Washington and was accosted by a Greenpeace campaigner, a professional Greenpeace campaigner, because as we all know, they get paid to do that. It's a pretty decent way to earn money if you're a college student. But it was a cold, rainy October day, and the rain was falling straight down. There was no breeze at all. And the person accosted me with this petition against nuclear energy, and I said, well, what do you want to do instead? And they said, wind and solar. And I said, I said, so can you tell me how much wind and solar power we'd be getting right now? And you know, it just boggles my mind how people can't simply observe the weather.
Yeah.
And I continue to ask people why they want to go back to a time where we had to wait for favorable weather in order to do things, where we had to wait for the sun to come up, or we had to wait for the wind to blow, or for the rain to stop. I just, you know, the reason that we use energy sources in many cases is to make ourselves independent of the weather. It's part of that tool thing that we talk about. You know, humans are problem solvers and or tool makers. It's another way to say it. I think that if in anthropological terms, they separate between a primate and a human by saying, did the is there any evidence that this population was using tools? You know, and that's kind of the difference. We like to find things that work, and I can't get past the fact that the best tool I can think of for producing reliable energy is a fuel source that does it without releasing any gases and does it in such a concentrated way.
A tiny amount of material. I always ask them, why is if solar power is our salvation, then why is it that I have to put on a coat in the wintertime on a bright sunny day? When I go outside.
Yeah, you can't collect enough, can you?
I can't collect enough, though. You know, there's all that stuff about all the solar energy striking every square centimeter of the Earth is enough to power civilization, yada, yada, yada. I still I can't warm a pot of water, putting it in my bedroom window on a sunny day in the wintertime, just with that.
Yes.
Well, you're expecting to be able to power our society doing this with motors that bring people up in elevators and turn lights on and pump water from the bottom floor of a 20-story building to the top floor. Give me a break.
You can't even get the water to get hot. Matter of fact, it will just simply freeze if you leave it just sitting in the window.
You couldn't even prevent it from freezing, exactly. and you're expecting to, and much less move it up and down, you know,
I think one of the, you know, there was a time when I was fascinated by the idea of renewable energy. I didn't have the numbers, so I would drive past a forest and see all the fallen logs and say, wow, look at all that wasted energy. Or I would, you know, I was a sailor and I would think about all, you know, how we could just move boats around. And then I took some courses and actually put numbers to it. And I think that the time that I recognized the complete folly of attempting to use solar energy was when I was tasked with designing a swimming pool heater. And I located the swimming pool in a reasonably sunny location. I did this for a swimming pool located in mid-California with, you know, good solar insulation, and ran the numbers and realized that in order to keep the swimming pool temperature at a moderate, not terribly warm, but a moderate temperature of 72 degrees, I would have to cover the pool for 12 hours a day to reduce the evaporation, because, of course, evaporation causes significant heat loss.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have to have a collector that was bigger than the pool in order to collect enough warmth to try to keep the pool warm. And then I realized that was in the summertime, and that was on a sunny day.
Yeah.
And I started to add the other factors in, and I said, this is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, and I read, you know, story. There was a Osha Gray Davidson recently wrote this, you know, paying to the Energy Wende program in Germany. You know, and it keeps saying things like, well, you know, Germany's got three times as much solar as the United States, and it's a place where the sun is about as reliable as Alaska. Why can't we do that? And my answer is exactly. Why would we want to do that?
Yeah.
You know, if your solar insulation is already that low, why would you spend your money
using that as your source?
Using that as your source. I mean, and then they say, well, it's popular because everybody benefits. And I say, how can everybody benefit? Somebody's paying the bill. You know, where is, and of course, the reality in general is that the bill is long delayed. It's comes in the form of a guaranteed above market rate feed-in tariff that's going to last for the next 20 years.
Pay me now or pay me later.
And they can, and people are agreeing, and so they seem to feel like there's a good benefit, but eventually that hangover is going to be there. It is a situation where the bubble is going to collapse.
Yep.
And, you know, of course, they're building a lot of coal and lignite plants. I guess Hamburg, which is supposedly one of the greenest cities in the world, has a 1.6 gigawatt coal plant being built where the plan is to use imported coal to power it.
Yep, that's
imported coal.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, Germany's got some good lignite research, and I've got a plan someday to put together this video. Using Google Earth, I flew to a lignite mine in Germany. Absolutely incredible experience. The size of the mine compared to the size of the plant, and it's a pretty good sized coal plant, but it was mind boggling how much land and how big the machines are to gather all this lignite. But you don't really move lignite very far. It's quite it's not a very energy dense fuel, so if you'd have to move it very far, you quickly spend more money in moving it than you do in capturing the energy from it.
It's essentially combustible dirt.
Yeah,
so well, it's literally combustible
well,
dirt.
Many people that I know call lignite power plants dirt burners.
Yeah.
But Hamburg is of course a port city with some terrific infrastructure, so they can actually import coal cheaper than they can bring it from someplace and ship it over land. Shipboard transportation is pretty cheap.
Yeah. Not if it was wind powered.
Well, that's true. Actually, one of the little projects I'm working on is to trying to figure out a way to rapidly build some nuclear powered ships. In the shipping market. This is something I'm trying to get people interested in. The alternative is you don't have to compete against cheap natural gas or cheap coal. Ships burn fuel oil. And up until recently, you still had to compete against high sulfur fuel oil. But in the last couple of years, the International Maritime Organization has recognized that having ships produce about half of the world's sulfur dioxide output because they were burning such high sulfur fuel was probably not a good thing. So they've restricted the sulfur content of marine fuels to the point where they're now having to burn essentially low sulfur diesel fuel. So the fuel costs for ships has now about doubled per unit of energy. So ships are actually doing what they call slow steaming for right now, trying to reduce their fuel consumption by simply going slow. It's not terribly productive for a transportation.
No, it's going to increase our costs.
Sure.
In the end.
Yeah, it'll increase. I'm very curious about why it is that nuclear commercial shipping has not taken off. It's got the same advantages of nuclear military shipping. You don't have to carry a huge amount of fuel with you, and you don't have to refuel except for every couple of years.
The argument I've heard, now I haven't studied it, so I'm not going to say this is absolutely the facts, but from a pro-nuclear economics guy, is that the problem is that a nuclear-powered ship requires a fairly large, fairly much higher-trained crew than a diesel-powered ship takes. So the cost of moving the goods would be quite a bit higher on a nuclear-powered ship. So at least so far, the companies that would do that haven't been able to, I'll say, thread the needle to make it happen. If you think about it, there's secondary issues here in that getting a license in any country to bring a nuclear-powered merchant ship into a port is probably going to be prohibitively expensive.
Well, you know, when I watched the video about the nuclear ship Savannah, one technical problem really struck me, and that is that if you have a nuclear power plant on land, there's quite elaborate testing and modeling that goes into what kind of seismic activity, what kind of ground motion can it stand. Well, this NS Savannah was decided to go through an area around a hurricane. And ships do that. I mean, they do. They find themselves closer to the typhoon center than they thought they were going to be, even with wonderful satellites and things. Well, that is way more than your average design. I mean, I was just thinking that, you know, submarines are really neat because they go under the water, and great big carriers are pretty famous for not being affected by waves unless the waves are very, very big. Anyway, I just am not totally sure that with our current reactor technology, which is, you know, solid state with water running around it and fuel rods and so forth and control rods, that this amount of shaking up in high seas is really what nuclear ships should have.
Well,
oh no, you'd have to do a fundamentally different design. There's just no two ways about it. It can be light water, but a fundamentally different kind of fuel. You can't do the skinny spaghetti rods you've got now.
Oh,
they wouldn't work.
Well, although Savannah had fuel rods that were not terribly different, and of course they weren't high enriched uranium. Savannah used 5% enriched. I'm not sure exactly what their fuel rods look like, although I can check my book. I have a
but this Savannah would have been old enough that it would have been if from a GE perspective, it would have been a fairly large, fairly robust, probably stainless steel clad fuel that could tolerate much larger accelerations than the current designs. It's just because the reactors are generally sit in one place and don't move around. We designers design them to optimize the uranium to hydrogen ratio, not the movability ratio.
Right. Well, and again, it's all a matter of what you tell the designers the optimal is.
Give us the constraints, we'll design you what you need.
Right. And the constraints when you build a ship is you make it so that, you know, it's not, I mean, the rolling and pitching that you get when you're at sea is a fairly easy thing to design against. But we actually design and test military ships to be shock tested. So, you know, the whole, I never could understand why people were worried about seismic for a nuclear powered power plant. Although now I realize that the scale is significantly different. But, you know, you can design a light water reactor to be able to withstand just about anything you can throw at it. I've operated a light water reactor at an angle of about 30 degrees and gone through the remnants of a hurricane. And, you know, we're doing a fair amount of pitching and rolling. You can't always submerge a submarine. Believe it or not, there are places in the world where we operate where the water is just not deep enough to submerge. So, you know,
But Yeah, and but to Meredith's point, you can't just take what we currently use for a land-based reactor and throw it on a ship.
Oh, absolutely not. And matter of fact, one of the I spent a lot of time thinking about this. By the way, one of the colleagues that I had in the or in the business of Adams Atomic Engines was a marine engineer from the Netherlands, and he made a good point that there's lots and lots of history of shipboard power plants moving ashore and being used on shore. There's almost no examples of shore-based power plants moving to sea and being reliably useful at sea.
And that makes sense.
If you don't design it to withstand the rigors of being at sea with the pitching and rolling and the chemistry implications of salt water, you're just simply not even worth trying to redesign it. So the point may be is, and maybe the Russians are going to be the ones that do this, take the shipboard reactors that we've been operating for the last 50 years and the modern ones, and then use those for commercial operations. I participated in a study when I was in the last couple of years in my Navy career where we showed that when oil prices were above $140 per barrel delivered, a nuclear-powered military ship was cheaper than an equivalent oil-fired ship to operate. That did not give any credit for additional capabilities, and it also made the assumption, which is a pretty valid assumption, that the military ship was only going to have a capacity factor of about 25% to 30%, because we don't operate at full power all the time. In contrast, a commercial ship will often operate at a very high capacity factor, because as soon as they leave port, if fuel costs are not an issue, they will crank it up to full power and travel at full power until they get to their destination. So the fuel cost in that mode is a much larger portion of the cost of operation. And also, Meredith, to the point of the crew costs, I was the guy for 3 years who did the analysis. I didn't write the checks because I really don't have a very big checkbook, but I did the analysis. I was a requirements officer on the OPNAV staff to analyze the cost of training for all submarine and surface ships. So I know what it costs to train a crew for nuclear power, and I also know what it costs to train a crew to operate a diesel plant, and the costs are not that big a difference, and they're even better now with the more modern nuclear plants where the designs have been optimized to reduce the amount of staff required.
Okay. I agree with you. I mean, the oil-burning ships, you know, they have definite drawbacks. I mean, they're burning rather, high sulfur, high polluting oil, because the assumption has always been that you're out at sea and it doesn't matter, you know. But now that we look at the world a little differently, then it would be better if we could move to nuclear ships. I just saw the movie about the Savannah and thought, well, it's not going to be quite that kind of nuclear ship in terms of the power plant, because when they decided to go through the edges of that hurricane, that was a very bad decision for that ship.
Oh, yeah, and they had some problems, but, of course, that ship was designed in 1958 or so. So it was built in the early 1960s, and certainly we can do better than the Savannah. It was a one-of-a-kind ship, and it was just a demonstration of the possibilities. A lot of times I've run into people who say, well, the Savannah experience proves that nuclear is not economical at sea, and I say, I'm sorry. Savannah was decommissioned when the price of oil was $2 a barrel. Because it was decommissioned before the Arab oil embargo.
I don't think that a one of a kind can prove anything.
Absolutely.
about economics. I mean, I was much more concerned with the pitching and rolling than whether or not it was economical to operate.
Yeah.
Because it seemed to me that, you know, when you get a prototype up there, you've got a lot of people having to watch over it as it goes through all its little trials. And once you've got thousands of them or something, or hundreds, it's a whole different ball game.
Yep. Yeah, well, one of a kind of anything is always expensive to build, and then it's really expensive to maintain it over time, because you end up going back and hand-making anything that breaks.
Right. First of a kind is never... I'll say first of a kind can demonstrate a problem in a concept, because you can discover that fundamentally something didn't scale, but it's never going to tell you about economics, or at least not going to be definitive on economics, and it's probably not going to be completely definitive on whether or not the design will work, even if it works at the first of a kind level, because it still may not scale correctly. But it does give you some demonstration. It gives you some indicators on.
Well, it's probably a true statement to say that if you don't build first of a kind, you'll never get to nth of a kind, right?
but the point is that anyone who says, well, I've built one and I've proved something,
right,
is overstating it on both sides of that coin.
Yeah, that's,
you've proved that you can build one.
That's
if
one
it
of
works,
the challenges I always have with the lifter folks or the molten salt reactor guys. They keep saying, we've built these before. And I say, yeah, go back and look at the history and see what you really built. And
right.
Tell me that you have as much knowledge as you think you have.
Right.
There's an awful lot of things you learn by building and operating and refining products. Evolutionary designs, actually, there's good precedent for that being the right way to be innovative, is to evolve rather than to be revolutionary.
There's a place for both, but it's what drives me nuts is when people overstate what they know when they are going somewhat revolutionary in what they're doing. We've built one, we built it 40 years ago, it operated for a few weeks. That does not constitute... that does not constitute true testing. This is like to the extreme. I was once given the privilege with my former and only employer to review a fusion project. I'm not going to say much about it because, you know, violate all those rules. But one of the conversations I got into with these people on this project was they said they demonstrated sustained reaction. And I said, really? Holding the plasma was what they were talking about. And I said, really? For how long? Oh, we held it for several nanoseconds. And I looked at him and said, come back to me when you've held it for a month.
Yeah.
And they looked at me and they said, what? And I said, if you want to do electricity for a country, you've got to hold it for a month, not a nanosecond, not even a second. All month. And they were just flabbergasted by that concept.
And that's just a start. You really have to do it for years.
Sure. But for a first of a kind, give me a month.
At least. Yeah.
At least. But, you know, my point being scale there. And so, you know, when people say, well, we operated one for a couple of weeks, it's like, that's good. You know, a few months is even pretty impressive. A couple of years is pretty good. But you got to show that these plants can operate for far longer.
So we're running a little bit towards the end, but I am going to poll the three of you and find out, has anybody ever heard of Galen Windsor?
I just read your blog. Otherwise, I hadn't. I'm sorry. Maybe I jumped out of the line of the polling. But
no, that's good.
If I hadn't read your blog, I wouldn't have heard of him.
I have not. I started to watch the video you sent me, Rod, and I do know some old timers based on the little bit I caught of it, he probably was at GE before me. He worked at Morris, which was GE's planned reprocessing facility. At least that was the claim I was hearing. Mm-hmm. And then he supposedly worked at the San Jose fuel plant, which closed in the late 60s, early 70s, when they opened the plant in Wilmington, which he then also claimed to have worked at. So that was a little ahead of my time. I started there in 81.
Well, he definitely was finished working with GE before you started. He started at Hanford in 1947 or 48 and claims to have worked for GE for about 26 years. So that would put him at the end of the 1970s.
Right, just ahead of me.
Sorry, not even that long. It would be early 70s.
Early 70s. So there are some guys that are still around that would have been working at GE back then. So I want to watch the rest of that video, and then I'm going to send some notes to my buddies. Most of them have retired now, so they're a little freer to talk and see if they can tell me anything about him. I haven't read your blog yet, so I'm a little curious what he said because I only got the first part of that video.
Well, in essence, he apparently went around and was making giving talks for a significant period of time with a speakers bureau and talking about how when he started the business, people would actually handle fuel just out of the reactor if necessary. They would kick it or whatever they needed to do with it and didn't ever really think much about radiation doses. As long as they weren't getting burned, they thought they were pretty safe, and gradually got many rules imposed upon him that he never could quite understand with his own knowledge and experience of what the effects were. And it's pretty interesting stuff. He tells stories about doing things like considering the used fuel pool at Morris, Illinois, his own personal warm swimming hole.
Yeah, I love that. It's an artificial hot spring.
You know, that's the XKCD comic talks about. You can swim in the top of a spent fuel pool and you're fine.
Mm-hmm.
There's no danger there. As long as you didn't dive down and,
Well, you'd have to be a pretty good diver to get down to where you would hurt yourself. Because even if I go down much more than about 12 feet, my ears start to get under pain. So I don't dive much deeper than that.
Right. There's some legends at GE. I never was able to validate the veracity of what they called the infamous Caorso divers. But the Caorso divers were involved in the construction of Caorso. It was a BWR-4 being built in Italy. We're mostly diving in the Taurus. So that would have been clean. It wouldn't have been radioactive.
Mm-hmm.
But not sure, and it would have been during construction, but there were some many, many stories about some wild stuff that went on there, but it was Italy, so who knows for sure. I am going to send some notes. I can't name them here, but there's a couple of guys who would have definitely been in, I'll say they were senior leaders when I started in 81, so they would have been high enough up the food chain to be well aware of him.
Mm-hmm.
So they would be able to validate at least the veracity of his employment and what he did to say there is truth to his claims. I knew some guys that worked at Hanford that were down in San Jose, but I'm not sure any of them are still alive, to be honest. So I'm going to try to run it down for you because I am curious myself.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I would like to hear some react. I mean, I've been studying nuclear stuff on the web for 20 years or more, and I never heard of him until somebody sent me a link and said, Rod, you've got to watch these videos. And they're certainly realistic. It's pretty obvious that it was filmed on videotape, and the guy was certainly no wild, crazy nutcase. He was certainly making a very straightforward, professionally delivered talk, and he did pass away himself of old age in his late 80s, just a few years ago. But to me, the stories that he told struck a lot of familiar notes. He talked about the fact that many of the rules were imposed, as he called it, made the feather bedding on the railroad engineers look like pikers, because it added so many additional layers of people and profit to increase the rules to the point where they were, and that it simply added to the cost of electricity for people that should be able to get electricity cheap. And of course, I also was amused that in giving his talks in the 1980s, he talked about his ideal power system was having small reactors every few city blocks producing power, where they were close enough to the customer where the heat could be used rather than going up in what he calls the wasting towers.
Hmm. Interesting. I, like I said, I had not never heard of him specifically, but I have a number of folks that are retired from GE. They'd be in their 70s and 80s now, so they would have been 20 years younger than him. Mm-hmm. But they would have been around when he was there, 10 years younger than him anyway. They would have been around, and they would have been in senior enough positions to be aware of some of it. One of my good friends, and I, when he was at GE, and he went back to San Jose, and I've not been able to keep in touch with him, actually worked at the spurt tests in Hanford and in Idaho, where they tested failures for enthalpy insertion events. And so he was quite expert in a lot of that. So it sounds like their careers might have been somewhat parallel.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I would imagine that there would be people at GE who at least heard of him giving his talks, if nothing else.
Absolutely. And did he leave GE here in Wilmington? And then, do you know, like I said, I haven't had a chance to watch the video yet, so I was up
traveling. I'm not sure when he left GE. He was at GE at Hanford for a good portion of his career. Then he was going to go, he thought that the plant that eventually got built at Morris, Illinois was going to be built in California, which he said that was how GE lured me out of Hanford, was that they promised me it'd be built in California, and then I ended up having to do the work in Illinois.
Yeah.
which he did. But then he did talk about, even mentioned laser isotope enrichment.
Interesting.
And Wilmington. So.
Yeah, because the laser isotope stuff, really, they didn't really get started on that until the 90s. That's it. I'll have to watch it and see what I can pick up from it. And then, like I said, I'll see if I can reach out to some of my retired buddies they've been out for a good 10, 15 years, so they'd be freer to talk. And they also would have been at GE during that, at least the end of his time frame there. So they would be maybe a little more familiar with whatever it was he was doing.
Good. Well, I'd be interested to hear what you find out, and I'm sure that other people who read my blog will be interested.
Yeah.
So any parting thoughts, Steve?
Well, we've got a decision time coming up in Ontario, and I'm confident in it that there will be a positive decision regarding new build. I'm one of the few people who thinks this. So that's my parting thought.
Do you think it's going to be can-do new build or something else?
I'd be really surprised if it was something else.
Okay.
The entire supply chain is in Canada. I don't understand, not to say that Westinghouse is not good. Of course they're good. I can't see how you make the argument that the reactor whose entire supply chain is in this country doesn't get picked.
Right, and all the experience is there too.
And all the experience, like, you know, the utilities are can-do utilities. So I'd be very, very surprised if it was a Westinghouse.
Okay. Meredith, how are things going up in Vermont?
Oh, they're just going along. You know, we have a Vermont Yankee plant here, and then we also have Mark Cooper of Vermont Law School expecting the demise of quite a few nuclear plants. And it kind of amazes me that he can sort of publish on the law school blog and it gets picked up all over the country. I mean, in other words, it wasn't really published in, you know, any kind of peer-reviewed journal, law journal, economics journal.
Well, it was published by a think tank, and they did a lot of press release, and I think the reason it got picked up, his most recent paper, was it tickled the interest of a lot of people by indicating a threat to the local nuclear plant. So he got a lot of people attending the press conference. Just a lot of questions. I listened to the press conference. It would have gone longer than an hour, but that was how much time they allotted, so they cut everything off. But and of course, I wrote at least one or two pieces about his lack of education in economics, and certainly his lack of knowledge of cost controls and improvements in industrial activities. But hey. You know, he's a think tank guy, and he works at the Vermont Law School, which I don't know where they get their funds, but they certainly have no love of nuclear energy.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's about it. You know, the legislature isn't in session. The Public Service Board has completed their official hearing, so they still, various things keep happening. So it's really kind of a relatively quiet time in Vermont. I'm almost scared to say that for fear something amazing will happen the next day, you know. But, you know, there's not a lot really going on at this point.
And, of course, Vermont Yankee is operating at near 100% power, right?
Right. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Supplying 600 megawatts to the grid. And if I also continue to be amused when people say, well, it doesn't supply any power to Vermont. And I say, do you really believe the electrons know where they're going when they come out of the plant?
I love using that. Do you know where your electrons really came from?
But it's really true. They kept saying, Vermont isn't using any of the power. We're not buying any of it. And I'm like, yeah, you're still using it. I mean, it has nothing changes because a different contract is written.
Well, yeah, I will certainly agree that some of the power from Vermont ends up other places, since Vermont Yankee is right at the corner of three states.
Yeah,
but
right.
Definitely some of those electrons end up being used locally in Vermont. Mm-hmm. You can't help it. That's the way the grid works.
This is the problem with deregulation, as you get cockamamie ideas like this. Well, it's not even staying in, it's going to somewhere else. Without deregulation, people wouldn't be saying stuff like that.
Well, that's part of that thing we talked about earlier. People often aren't very well educated about how things really work in the world. There's less and less people taking things apart and understanding how electricity flows and those kind of cool things that are fun to learn in school, but as Margaret pointed out, they do require some amount of investment in laboratory equipment.
Yep. Can't do chemistry without making stuff.
Of course, we do have enough money to buy iPads in many school systems. So.
But that's cool.
Oh, well. Margaret, thank you very much for helping me out with that teacher workshop. It was fun for me. The timing wasn't quite right because I ended up doing that 1 week after having been in charge of a 3-day meeting for a group of 330 people, and I didn't have a huge team. I had enough help to make it turn out to be a well-received event, but man, I was stressed by it.
Yeah, that's hard work. The events like that, though, are fun. The teachers were enthusiastic. They asked good questions. And I have hope for the students in their classrooms. They would be fun teachers to have.
Yes.
On the note on Mark Cooper, Meredith, to improve your day just a little bit, I was talking with a reporter from Platts. So, you know, we all know what Platts is, one of the more respected energy journalism groupings. They have several magazines on various aspects of energy, right? I was talking with a reporter, and we were talking about something totally different. And then he said, by the way, have you read Mark Cooper's latest article, column, whatever he called it? And I said, I don't bother because it's just the same stuff over and over again. I just don't bother to read him. And the guy laughed, and he said, you do have a point. And he said, I don't understand why he gets traction either.
Is that a Platts nuclear guy? Must have been a Platts nuclear guy.
It's a Platts nuclear guy, yeah. I try not to name him on these because I don't want to get him in trouble. So Mark is not infinitely accepted out there by the journalists. I think Rod has it right. He named a lot of plants were going to close early. So the journalists from those area papers were clearly very, very interested in what he was claiming because it would affect their local economies.
Absolutely. And I'm looking forward to hopefully attending a rather unusual Platts event for me. There's a coal marketing event in Pittsburgh, and I want to go there because one of the first things that the marketing material said was that they're going to talk about the effect of low natural gas prices on the coal market.
That's killing them. It's killing them.
So I thought it might be worthwhile going.
Well, coal plants around here that were running at 70% to base load are running 10 to 30%. There's no question.
Which, if you're in the business of selling coal, is not a good thing. Mm-hmm. And I personally kind of like coal, at least. I mean, it's got its drawbacks, but it's at least domestic. It provides good, steady jobs for people. It can be burned pretty cleanly, and it's really good raw material if you want to try to produce chemicals and whatnot, as long as you've got a good, clean heat source, too.
Great.
And it's flexible on a grid.
Yeah.
It's got its place.
It's got its place. It's just, like I've written and talked about before, I'd like to see us moving our carbon-based sources down into, take it out of electricity, move it to industrial heat and transportation, and then move it out of that.
Yeah.
But one step at a time.
Yeah, one step at a time. Well, thank you all for taking the time to chat. It's always a pleasure.
Absolutely.
Good luck to the
thank you,
the little activities that you're doing, all the big activities you're doing. Hope that the energy education project continues to grow. You mentioned that you've got a newsletter coming out, Meredith. Is that something?
No, not really. It's just that I signed up with Constant Contact, so instead of sending emails that are just texts that I write myself and then have to send 20 at a time so I don't get marked as a spammer. Constant Contact, I can write it once. It can look very beautiful. And they keep track of everything. They keep track of what bounces and the reason it bounces. And it's just really a whole different experience of managing the email list with a service like that. So I hope I gave anybody who would like to be on my email list, I plan to send an email about energy issues and events and in the Northeast. I plan to send one once a week, once every 2 weeks. Can you just write me at mjangwin, mjangwin at Gmail, and I'll be happy to put you on the list.
All right.
I think I'm on it already.
I
won't
you
be
are.
Hitting the unsubscribe. Don't worry.
Yeah, I know that you. I don't know if Margaret got one, but I know that you.
I did not.
You did not. Should I put you on the list then, Margaret?
I just sent you an email to put me on the list.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
And you can add me to the list too.
Oh, who? Rob, you have. You're getting it already, aren't
Am
you?
Am I? Well, if I'm getting it, I must have set a spam filter wrong because I don't remember getting it.
It's a little confusing because the from address is Energy Education Project. And one of my dear friends, a woman who's very, very enthusiastic and has been in all sorts of rallies with me about Vermont Yankee, she said, I didn't get anything from you, Meredith. And I said, well, yes, you did. It was, oh, was Energy, that from
yeah,
you?
Yeah. It doesn't say from Meredith Angwin. It says,
yeah, no, it says, and I'm thinking that I'm going to have to change that. I've been trying to be, like, official, you know, because there is an energy education project. It exists and so forth. And so I wanted this to look, you know, like
that's
the
energy
good. Education project. But then people are saying, oh, I didn't open it. That isn't good either.
I'm just checking my inbox, and I don't have anything from the energy education project,
yeah,
even in my spam. So I must not be on the list.
I didn't get anything like that either. And I would tell you, Meredith, stick with your energy education. Put out one last 20 at a time email and explain what you're doing.
Okay.
Because that way you're branding the Energy Education Institute, which is kind of what you want to be doing here, I think.
Absolutely.
Right.
It's an important, okay. And I really love the whole name and the concept. It's a great thing and
yeah,
something that we need more of.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay. I will check on that, and I will. I have a note to myself among many things I have to do. Follow up about that email.
All right. Thank you all. Have a good
thank
evening.
Thank you, Red.
All right. Bye.
Good night.
There's a way, such a better way today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way today. There's a better way. There's a way, such a better way today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adams way.